The scripture reading this morning is from Revelations 2, verses 8 to 11. To the angel of the church in Smyrna write, "These are the words of him who is the first and the last, who died and came to life again. I know your afflictions and your poverty, and yet you are rich. I know about those who slander. I know about the slander of those who say they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. Do not be afraid of what you are about to suffer. I tell you, the devil will put some of you in prison to test you, and you will suffer persecution for 10 days. Be faithful, even to the point of death, and I will give you life as your victor's crown. Whoever has ears, let them hear what the Spirit says to the churches. The one who is victorious will not be hurt at all by the second death."
155 AD, February. At this very site here, this site of a ancient Roman theater in ancient Smyrna, Asia Minor, there was a mob that was gathered, and they were chanting, "Away with the atheist! Away with the atheist! Away with the atheist!" And by atheist, they meant Christians. The Romans, ancient Romans, used to call Christians atheists because the Christians refused to go to the Roman pagan temples and refused to have any idols, so they assumed they had no gods at all. And you see, the people at Smyrna, they were deeply patriotic. They were fiercely loyal to Rome. In fact, they had earned the title first in Asia because they were the first city in Asia Minor, in ancient Turkey, to receive the honor by Caesar himself of becoming a site of imperial worship, where there was a temple to Caesar erected. You see, in ancient Smyrna, the declaration on every lip, every mouth, every tongue confessed, and every heart believed that Caesar is Lord. But now there are these atheists, these Christians, who say that if you confess with your mouth and believe in your heart that Jesus is Lord, you will be saved. They're confessing that Jesus is Lord. And it is treasonous. It's ruining their city. It's ruining their culture. It's taking their jobs from them. Actually, some of the temple, the markets that came from the food sacrificed to idols that came from the temples, the Christians are discouraging people from eating there, from shopping there, and people are losing their jobs over this. And we hear that they have like these secret gatherings on Sunday mornings where they're like doing some perverted thing and they're drinking blood and eating flesh. So the Roman proconsul, the head of the city, is there at this very site, and he sees this crowd and realizes they are not going to leave until they're appeased. So he starts by taking a well-known Christian named Germanicus, we know this from the historical records, and he throws him to the wild beasts. But rather than appeasing them, they start shouting even more. They're even angrier. It builds even more. But this time the cry is not "away with the atheists," it's "Bring us Polycarp! We want him dead!" So Polycarp, we actually have a fairly ancient mosaic of him. He's the second from the left there. He was the bishop of Smyrna. At the time of this event, he's 86 years old, which in the second century was ancient. You know, think medical technology involved things like leeches and cabbage at the time, right? So this guy is old, but he had been in Smyrna for decades. As a teenager, he had actually been a disciple of the Apostle John himself. And then as an adult, he became a great leader of the early church. In fact, he discipled Irenaeus, who is one of the most influential pastor theologians in the history of the church. And he also famously helped form our Bible as we know it. So when the heretic Marcion started declaring Christians don't believe the Old Testament, that's a different God, he stood against him. In fact, there's a recording of when the two of them met for the first time, and Marcion, who thought a lot of himself, said, "Do you know who I am?" And Polycarp is supposed to have said, Irenaeus records this, said, I know you. I know the firstborn of Satan. Hey, good to meet you. Yeah, here's my business card. So by the time we get here, though, 155 AD, like I said, he is very old. and he's off. He's not so worried about this. So the soldiers are sent out, though. This mob is raging in the stadium, and they send out these soldiers to search house from house, find us Polycarp, bring him back to us. And they go, and they start shaking down all the Christians, where they supposed Christians. One of them finally caves and tells them the location of Polycarp. And so as the story goes, they show up to his house, and he's praying, and they're ready to bash down the door. And he's like, you don't need to do that. It's okay. I'm ready for you. And he goes with them quietly. They bring him to the theater, and the next part of the story is actually worth reading. We have a very, very early account of this day. It's called the Martyrdom of Polycarp. It's about a 15-minute read. You need to look it up and read it this week. Michael Holmes, who's like the leading scholar on this era and on this topic, he gives evidence that it was written no later than 156 AD, so within a year of these events. Here's a taste. The proconsul, we're now in the stadium, Polycarp standing in front of him. The proconsul sought to persuade Polycarp to deny Christ, saying, have respect to your age, and many other similar things according to their custom, such as, swear by the fortune of Caesar, repent, say away with the atheist. But Polycarp, gazing with a stern countenance on all the multitudes, so he looks around at the crowds, and he waves his hands towards them and says, away with the atheist. Then the proconsul urged him, saying, swear, and I'll set you free. Denounce Christ. And Polycarp declared, this is my favorite line, 86 years have I served him, and he never did me any injury. How then can I blaspheme my king and my savior? When the proconsul yet again pressed him and said, swear by the fortune of Caesar, he answered, since you are vainly urgent that as you say, I should swear by the fortune of Caesar and pretend not to know who and what I am, hear me declare with boldness, I am a Christian. And if you wish to learn what the teachings of Christianity are, appoint a day and you shall hear them. The proconsul then threatens him with wild beasts, but Polycarp's just like, call them. I'm ready. So he says, I'm going to burn you alive. To which Polycarp replies, you threaten me with fire which burns for an hour and after a little is extinguished, but you are ignorant of the fire of the coming judgment and of eternal punishment reserved for the ungodly. Why do you tarry? Bring forth what you will. Bring it. And then that day, 86-year-old Polycarp, Bishop of Smyrna, was turned into a whole burnt offering. He offered his very body as a living sacrifice to God and became what we call a witness. In Greek, the word is martyr. So our text for today is Revelation chapter 2, verses 8 through 11, page 992 in your pew Bible. And yes, you should turn there. You're going to want to see this one. It's a letter from Jesus to the church at Smyrna, Polycarp's church. Polycarp's church. Polycarp would have been about 21 years old when John recorded these words. And at the time, the church is already facing severe persecution. And the message of this letter is really simple, basic. I mean, anyone can get it. Here's the message. As the Roman government is getting ready to hunt them down and kill them one by one, Jesus says to them, do not be afraid of what you're about to suffer. That's the message. As they're coming to kill you, do not be afraid. As they're coming to torture you, do not be afraid. Now, this letter is not hard to understand. We can reconstruct the historical context with greater clarity than maybe any other text in the New Testament. Like, we know what is happening there. The language is not complex. The history is not not obscure. It's not hard to understand. But sitting here today in our comfortable, safe, suburban church, it is hard to imagine. It's a letter that's hard to receive. And it's really hard to live. So here's the setup. Here's the context. For Romans chapter 2, here's the scene. It's 90 AD. Domitian is currently emperor of Rome, and he has this demand for absolute loyalty. You must be loyal to me and to Rome. And if he thinks that you might maybe not be loyal to him, he's going to take you and banish you, send you off, exile you, or kill you. And he does this to thousands and thousands of leaders across the Roman Empire, including the Apostle John. John, who was in Ephesus at the time, gets banished, gets exiled to the island of Patmos. And so there, just 60 miles off the coast on the island of Patmos, one Sunday morning, John is worshiping, just like us, Sunday morning worship. And he receives this vision, this revelation that we know as the revelation of Jesus Christ, the book of Revelation. And when in this book of, in this vision, this revelation, Jesus pulls back the veil. It's an apocalypse. That's what apocalypse means, to pull back the veil, to see behind things. So we are allowed to see behind this world, what is in and under and behind the forces that are at work politically, economically, and the like in this world. When Jesus pulls back the veil in this letter, we see that this world of wealth, power, violence, pleasure, this world is controlled by dark forces that demand your allegiance and your worship. They demand it. And if you refuse, they will make you suffer. It will cost you dearly, and they may kill you. And at the same time, throughout the whole book, we hear Jesus say, do not be afraid. Not because you won't suffer, not because they won't kill you, not because not all of that's not true. It is absolutely true. The world is coming for you. It will kill you. It will destroy you. It will make you suffer unless you conform to what it wants for your life. But do not be afraid, because I have overcome the world. That's the message of Revelation. And I would suggest that is at the very heart of the message of Christianity. There's this paradox. They're coming to kill you, and you don't have to be afraid. You will face immense suffering in this life, and through it, you're going to find a life that this world knows nothing about. This paradox lays at the heart of, as I said, Revelation, the teaching of the apostles, and what it means to follow Jesus. And somehow, these early Christians, not just Polycarp, but even before Polycarp, They got it. They lived it. They believed this. So Paul is in prison, right? And he's like, I'm not sure if I'm going to make it out of here. Like, I think they're going to kill me. And he writes what we call the Epistle of Joy, the book of Philippians. He says, rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I'm going to say rejoice. Peter gets beaten. He gets flogged. Acts chapter 5. Flogged 49 times till his back is ripped open. One more and they'll kill you type of thing. 49 lashes. So he gets flogged. And then we read in the very next verse, he is rejoicing because he had been counted worthy of suffering disgrace for the name. He's rejoicing in his suffering. Jesus, Sermon on the Mount. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness. Blessed are you when people insult you, persecute you, and falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. Rejoice and be glad. Be glad, because great is your reward in heaven, in the same way they persecuted the prophets who are before you. This is the paradox. They're coming to kill you. Don't be afraid. So, I've been wrestling with this text all week, and I don't want to pretend like I figured this one out. This one has an edge for me. I don't want to suffer. As I've prayed about this week, I've discovered I fear suffering. You can ask my wife. Like, if we don't have almond milk for my coffee, I'm like, no, dear Lord, how long? I'm such a baby. And most of us are. I'm not saying that suffering's good. We don't want to say that. But I do want to say this paradox is core to Christianity. Suffering is coming for you. But you don't have to be afraid. So here's my prayer. It's a very uncomfortable prayer. that I'm praying for us today. May this message unsettle you. May these words make you uncomfortable with your comfort. May you leave here with a peace that passes understanding or troubled by your lack of peace. May you leave here with a burden to pray for those who are persecuted and a boldness to stand if persecution should ever come. That's my prayer. Revelation chapter 2, starting in verse 8, begins like this. To the angel of the church in Smyrna write. So this is the setup. This is the angel. We're not quite sure what that is. The messenger of the church in Smyrna. But the church in Smyrna would be just up the coast from ancient Ephesus in Asia Minor, modern day Turkey. This is a letter John's writing from Patmos around 90 AD from a vision of Jesus. These are the words of him who is the first and the last who died and came to life. So the ancient Smyrnans, they thought a lot about themselves. Remember, I'd already mentioned that they called themselves the first in Asia because they were honored to allowed to have imperial worship, the first city in all of Asia to have imperial worship in their hometown, which was a great honor. Basically, they said, Rome likes us best. In fact, they minted coins in the day that said, Smyrna, first in Asia. We're the best. In fact, if you go to the site today, there's this there's ancient graffiti in the Agora, the marketplace in downtown ancient Smyrna. And on this, you can see on the right, you can kind of see a gladiator there, which I just love that they do it. They're ancient gladiators. And then next to it, it says, if you can read ancient Greek script, it says Smyrna, the first in Asia. But then someone has come along and kind of etched it out and inserted the word Ephesus. See, there's this competition back in the day, whether Ephesus, Pergamum, or Smyrna was the greatest. And this seems to be a big part of their cultural battle of who's the greatest. All this to say, Jesus starts his letter and says, I'm the first. I'm the first. So this could be a reference to what's happening in their culture, and it likely is. But he doesn't just say, I'm the first. He says, I'm the first and the last, which certainly means more than that. This is what grammar books called merism. Merism is it's a rhetorical device in which a combination of two contrasting parts are used to refer to the whole. So you guys know this. You know this. Like if you buy a car, you get a bumper-to-bumper warranty. You're not just getting a warranty on the bumpers, I hope, right? This means everything between the bumpers is covered. Everything's covered. So if you search high and low, you're not just searching high and low. You're saying we searched everywhere. This is the sense of this. Jesus says, these are the words of him who is the first and the last. So I'm before all things. In the beginning was the word. Jesus is the word that created all things. He's the reason, the logic, the one who makes sense of all things. And he's the last. I'm the end. The telos, the true aim of all things. So your marriage, your vocation, the way you feel after a good meal with friends, it points to me. I mean, you read through the scriptures, and we're talking like everything, a piece of bread, a glass of wine, a cup of cold water, a gentle breeze. It points to me. Everything in creation is pointing to him. He is why the catbird cries out and the trees of the field clap their hands. He is what you are longing for, even when you don't have words to speak it. Which is to say, nothing happens that is not, to quote the Apostle Paul, from him and through him and for him. Everything in this world is in this life is under his sovereign control. So the Smyrnans, those in ancient Smyrna facing persecution, they desperately needed to hear this. This was not a nice little theological point about the sovereignty of God. This was a message that they desperately needed to hear, and some of us desperately need to hear. One of my favorite little books is a book by Dallas Willard called Renovation of the Heart, and he has this section where he talks about his morning routine. And when he wakes up in the morning, still in bed, he goes through, meditates on, starts with the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, right? And then if he has time, sometimes he adds in Psalm 23. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. And then before his feet hit the ground, he says he commits everything in his day to the Lord. Everything. I give my day to you. And here's the key line in the text. Then, as he steps out into his day, he says, then I meet everything that happens as sent or at least permitted by God. And Dallas is convinced that by surrendering control to God, or rather just acknowledging that I'm really not in control, only God already is in control, and genuinely trusting that whatever comes today is in his loving hands and the hands of the one who loves me, Willard suggests that this is how we can find a real rest in the midst of the storm. How we can be a non-anxious presence in a world that is racked by anxiety. How you and I can become the kind of person who is filled with the Spirit of Jesus to live the life of Jesus in love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, as opposed to fear, anxiety, depression, insecurity, selfishness. I think Willard's on to something here. But the hard part, the hard part, is that little word, everything. Because everything includes uncertainty, cancer, divorce, addiction, betrayal, injustice, smoke from Canadian wildfires, school shootings, everything. Which begs the question that we come up to time and again in the scriptures. If Jesus is the first and the last, which he is, if he's in control of all things and all things are under his loving, sovereign control in the hands of a loving Father, why would Jesus allow suffering? And I want to acknowledge this, but let me immediately say, I do not want to pretend like I have this one figured out. This is a real question. I myself am troubled with it. And as I read the scriptures, I find that the authors of scripture are troubled with this. In fact, there are entire sections of the Bible. Read Job's, Psalms, Ecclesiastes. Whole sections of the Bible are devoted to helping you ask these questions of God himself, to pray these questions. Read the Psalms. They're full of this. Why, Lord? How long, O Lord? Whole books are devoted to this. But in the end, God never explains it. He never solves this problem for us. Occasionally, like in the story of Joseph, he will actually show us how he uses evil and suffering for his own good purposes, how he does that. Every once in a while, we'll get a glimpse, but for every one answer, we get, there are 1,000 other unanswered questions hanging out there. And yet, let me be clear here. This is not to say that God does not answer our questions. He does answer this question. You know what his answer is? His answer is, I am with you. His answer is Jesus, God with us. That God the Son took on flesh, entered into our suffering, became like us, took our suffering, joined us in it, and then died on the cross for us and overcame it. And my favorite answer from the scripture is John chapter 11. He shows up. His dear friend Lazarus has died. He sees the crowd come to him and they're all weeping. And what's his answer? Two words. Jesus wept. He weeps with us. This might not be the answer you're looking for, but this might just be the answer we most need. If you're suffering today, and I know many of you are, know that you are not alone. So my favorite, outside of the scriptures, the person who's most challenged and encouraged me is actually an interesting woman. She was young at the time, has now passed away since. Her name's Corrie Ten Boom. Do you know the name? She was a Holocaust survivor, Christian. Ended up in a concentration camp. I first stumbled upon her work when I was in college. And at the time, I was reading reading these brilliant scholars and philosophers and things. And I pick up her little book, The Hiding Place. And I was like, what is this, written by like a 10-year-old? Like the language is so simple. And then I got about halfway in it and I repented in sackcloth and ashes and said, dear God, this woman is wiser than anyone I've ever read. I was utterly humbled by this simple, simple woman. In it, she's sitting in a concentration camp and tells the story of how she would cry out, why, Father, to God? Why are you allowing these people to die all around me? Why are you allowing such suffering? Why? And the answer that she received is God kept drawing back in her mind the story of when she was a little girl. She was a little girl and they're on a train, her and her dad. And her dad was a watchmaker. And he had this heavy, heavy bag that had all of his tools in it, like 70, 80 pounds, right? And it was up on the shelf in the train car. And she's traveling somewhere with her dad. He's going to go fix some watches or something. And she had asked her dad this question, Daddy, how are babies made? And the father, very wisely, got up, didn't answer. He just took his bag off the shelf, set it down on the floor and said, Corey, will you do me a favor? Will you carry my bag for me? And she got up, all proud, and she tried to lift it. She couldn't lift it. She was just completely exhausted and said, I can't. And he said, I wouldn't be a very good father if I asked you to carry something you weren't strong enough to carry, would I? For now, you're just going to have to trust me to carry it for you. He wouldn't be a very good father if he asked us to carry things that were too heavy for us, would he? So now we're going to have to learn how to trust him. But we do not have to trust him without reason, because these are the words of him who is the first and the last, who died and came to life again. We know that we can trust him. Why? Because Jesus died and came to life again. He defeated death. That he came, he entered into our suffering. He's with us in it, and then he defeated it. He overcame it, and he is alive. That Christ is risen, Paul says. He's risen indeed. He's risen indeed. This is the cry of every Christian heart from the beginning. This is why it makes sense. This is why you can suffer. This is why we're not overcome by the world, because he already overcame it. So the Apostle Paul will then later write, who himself immensely suffered, that because Jesus defeated death and overcame the world, there's literally nothing in this world that he can't undo. That's our hope. There's literally nothing in this world that can happen to you, that can be done to you, that you can do, that he himself cannot undo. So the Apostle Paul says, I consider that our present sufferings, they're not worth comparing to the glory that will be revealed. He says, and we know that in all things, everything, he's talking about suffering here. God is, he works for the good of those who love him and have been called according to his purpose. We know. We can be confident even in our suffering. In fact, he'll go on so far to say, I am convinced that neither death nor life, angels nor demons, neither the present nor future nor powers, nothing. Nothing in this world, neither height nor depth nor anything else in all creation will be able to separate us from the love of God that is in Christ Jesus our Lord. It is because Jesus entered into our suffering and then defeated it that we can be confident. Verse 9, I know your afflictions and your poverty, yet you are rich. So in first century world, Christianity often had economic implications. So a lot of Jews would be excluded from all of their Jewish business partners and Jewish business. This is why the Jews in Jerusalem were particularly impoverished. And in fact, the Apostle Paul goes around and takes a collection for the Jewish Christians in Jerusalem because they were so impoverished, you might recall. And then in ancient Rome, we know that when the gospel went out, the gospel was declared and Jesus was the one who said, blessed are the poor. So many of the poorest classes came to Christ, while many of the more wealthy people didn't. So we don't know if the Christians in Smyrna are hated because they're poor, or if they're poor because they're hated. What we do know is that they are both poor and hated, which is actually really common among Christians, even in our world today. couple weeks ago, I grabbed dinner with a couple from Pakistan, a part of our church, and they the home cooking Pakistani was amazing. Like the type of spices that you feel in your toes, like your whole body's glowing. It was amazing. Anyways, and so we were sitting there eating like curries and talking about Jesus and faith and Pakistan and Christianity in Pakistan. And what I didn't quite know is I knew a little bit, but they told me that Christianity in Pakistan was largely oppressed. That's why they had left post 9/11. And that Christianity, when it first came from the British who used to rule that region, among the Pakistanis, the lower class, you think caste system, like the untouchables, they were the ones who just received it greedily. Yes, this is a message of grace. Someone actually loves us. Someone gives us value. And so they all became Christians, but the upper class in general rejected it. So that to this day, 95% of all Christians in Pakistan are the poorest of poor living in slums. So this couple, in fact, they've since they've been in America, they felt called by God to start a school in the slums there in Karachi to raise these children out of poverty. And if you would like to help them in some way or feel like called to help them, please contact me and I'll connect you with them. But my point is this. Being poor and afflicted, as the people of Smyrna were, this is a reality for millions of Christians today. And yet, by Jesus' accounting, yet you are rich. By according to Jesus' accounting, Christians living in the slums of Karachi might just be richer in the things that matter to him than us sitting here today. I know about the slander of those who say they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. Jews who say they're Jews but are not a synagogue of Satan. Let me just acknowledge, you're not actually allowed to say this today. It's not okay. This sounds anti-Semitic, but let me just lower the temperature level here a little bit. This wasn't written today, and it's written by Jews, right? Jesus is a Jew. John is a Jew. This is not anti-Semitic. Jesus is not talking about Jewish people in general. He's talking about these particular Jews who've rejected him as Messiah, and now they are actively slandering, that's the word he uses, those who confess that Jesus is Lord. And then he goes on to call them a synagogue of Satan. And here, this isn't just like a bad name, like you're synagogue of Satan. That Satan is from the Old Testament. You might recall this from a few weeks ago. There's a title, Ha Satan, which literally means the accuser or adversary. He's saying that this is what they're doing. They are literally accusing. They're acting as the adversary of the Christians in Smyrna. And we have reason to believe, which you'll understand from the historic context here in a minute, that these Jews, what they're doing by slandering is that they were going to the Roman officials and saying, hey, I know where Christians are, so that those Christians would be hunted down, imprisoned, and possibly killed. And this brings us to the realization that the persecution that they are facing is thankfully unlike anything you or I have faced, at least in America, in our lifetime. So I know that it's popular, especially among the political parties, to act like we are a terribly persecuted minority. And I do not deny that there is increasing pressure to conform to our world. But being hunted down and killed, this is not our reality. This is not what we're facing right now, guys. Our persecution looks more like the government might force you to bake a cake. I'm not joking, right? It means your barista now says happy holidays instead of Merry Christmas. Okay. I'm not saying that the pressure isn't real. And we talked about it last week. We're going to talk about it in the weeks to come. It is real. It's palpable. You can feel it in the air. And to quote Jesus, people might insult you, falsely say all kinds of evil against you because of me. And that is a type of persecution. But nobody's trying to kill you. And when you realize that these are people who are literally being hunted down and killed, well, then you can start to appreciate how extraordinary verse 10 is. Do not be afraid, Do not be afraid of what you're about to suffer. I tell you, the devil will put some of you in prison to test you, and you will suffer persecution for 10 days. Be faithful even to the point of death, and I will give you life as your victor's crown. Do not be afraid. You're going to be tested, but I'm going to give you life. So let's put this in context. We don't know exactly what the testing looked like in ancient Smyrna, but we have a really, really good idea. We're going to take a little detour into a historic context here that's going to serve us this week and next week, okay? So 20 years after this letter is written, just around the corner in a place called Bithynia and Pontus, we know what this testing looks like. So let me introduce you to this guy, Pliny the Younger. So in 111 AD, Pliny the Younger becomes governor of Pontus in Galatia. So this little highlighted dot, that's Smyrna right there. And we're talking about the Asia, the place that's called Asia on this map. This is an ancient Roman map of what we call Turkey. And then right around the corner is where Pliny was governor, Pontus in Galatia. So just down the road from all of this, he becomes governor. To set a little context, Pliny is kind of a big deal. Kind of a big deal. He's from a family of wealth. His family had the in with the Caesars from the beginning. And so Pliny the Elder, which some of you may have heard of, because I was forced to read him in college. He wrote natural histories. He was like this adventurer, military man, famous. He actually was so studied natural history that he moved to Pompeii to study the volcano, and then it exploded on him and he died. But Pliny the Younger has every bit the same amount of ambition as his uncle. In his 20s, he starts working for Caesar, who at the time was Domitian, and he just climbs the social ladder. And by his 30s, he not only gets a elevated position in the government, he gets the official title of priest. I want you to hear this, because this is something that it kind of blows our categories here. Priest was a government position. It was a place of honor. The priesthood, it was a public office that could be bequeathed upon you by Caesar himself. I referred to the book, The Christians as the Romans Saw Them, by Robert Louis Wilkins last week. He has an excellent little quote that kind of puts some flesh on this. He says this: because the Romans thought the official cults, the worship, were an integral part of public life of the city, they took for granted that the priesthood should be offered to prominent social and public figures. Which is to say, Pliny the governor and Pliny the priest are one thing. That's one thing in their mind. To be a governor and a priest, that's the same thing. So when Pliny, the governor priest, shows up in Bithynia Pontus and discovers that there's this club, that's what he called Christians, there's this social club, I guess. What are these people? It's Jesus Club. There's this Jesus Club that refuses to participate in Roman worship or declare that Caesar is Lord. This sounds to him like treason. Holy cow. There's a club who refused to declare that Caesar is Lord. And we know all this because from 111 AD on, he goes on to write 60 letters to Emperor Trajan. We have all those letters. So at this point, Christianity was still exceedingly small. So we have reason to believe that Pliny thought that Christians were like some type of secret sex society that ritually ate human flesh. So when he meets a Christian, his immediate reaction is, "Ah, you're a Christian? I will execute you." The only good Christian is a dead Christian. That's his basic policy. And he writes that to Trajan. Trajan's like, totally, that absolutely makes sense. So that's what he does. He just starts killing anyone who declares that they're a Christian. But then some of the locals get all amped up. They like see their opportunity in this. And they write him a secret pamphlet in which they list everyone accused of being a Christian, and they send it to him. Let's kill all the Christians. And Pliny writes to Trajan, like, what do I do with this? If they're a Roman citizen, I can't kill them. I can't execute them without a trial. And what if I bring them in front of me and they deny that they're a Christian? What do I do about that? So he says, I know what I'll do. I will come up with a test. And then he writes this to Trajan. Those who do not, so anyone who doesn't deny Christ, he immediately kills them. And Trajan's like, yes. Those who denied that they were or had been Christians, when they invoke the gods and words dictated by me, so they have to invoke the names of the gods, offer prayer with incense and wine to your image, so they're going to worship Caesar, and moreover, curse Christ, none of which those who are really Christians, it is said, can be forced to do, these I thought should be discharged. So if you go through that test and you pass the test, then you can be discharged. Anyone who can't pass that test is killed. But then as he's torturing them one by one, some of them are like, wait, why are you doing this? Christians aren't doing anything bad. We meet on Sunday mornings, we sing a few songs to Jesus, and then we have a meal, a real meal, no blood, no animal, no human sacrifice. What's going on here? And so he decides, okay, let me check this out. So he says, accordingly, I judged it all the more necessary to find out what the truth was by torturing two female slaves who were called deaconesses. But I discovered nothing else but depraved, excessive superstition. It's like, well, shoot, I guess they're telling the truth the whole time. They just had this weird superstition about this guy named Jesus. So we have reason to believe that this test, this type of torture, this type of dehumanizing force was exactly what was happening in Smyrna 20 years earlier. So when it says the Jews are slandering the Christians, they are sending the Christians to the Romans so that Romans do what Romans do. And Jesus says, don't be afraid. Not because it's not coming. Not because you won't suffer. Not because some of you won't die. Some of you will. But be faithful even to the point of death. And I, the first and the last, I will give you life as your victor's crown. Whoever has ears, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. The one who is victorious will not be hurt at all by the second death. That the first death, you might die. That the death of the physical death, the separation between body and spirit, where it's ripped apart. That may happen. And if Jesus doesn't come back, that will happen to every single one of us. But the second death, where your life is, your soul is permanently separated from God forever. We call that hell. You'll be saved from that. According to the scriptures, the whole purpose of this life is to find life with God. And Jesus wants us to know you will not find that life by avoiding suffering. That's not how you find the good life. Like, if you want the life of Jesus, if you want life with God, you have to follow Jesus, the same Jesus who suffered, the same Jesus who went to the cross, the same Jesus who died, and then 3 days later rose again. His resurrection life is not found by avoiding the cross. It's found through the cross. If you want to become like Jesus, it is not by avoiding suffering. It is through suffering. Through surrendering everything to God and trusting everything into his hands and praying, into your hands I commit my spirit. And we have reason to believe that the early Christians not only confessed this, but they lived it. Now, I'm not just talking about the apostles. The earliest Christians, we know from history that tens of thousands joyfully went to gave their life. Offered their lives as a living sacrifice to God, that they followed Polycarp's example and Paul's example and Peter's example and Jesus' example. That through their suffering, they showed a peace and a joy and a hope that this world could not understand. And to this day, hundreds of thousands of Christians around the globe live this same truth. They do not fear suffering and death for the sake of Jesus because they know Jesus. They know that he's with them. They know that he suffered and that he conquered it. In the words of the modern martyr, Jim Elliot, who died bringing the gospel to Ecuador, he is no fool who gives what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose. Whoever has ears, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. The one who is victorious will not be hurt at all by the second death. Now, I have a lot more I could say. Research from psychologists on the study of martyrs, on this the way in which early Christians actually found joy and peace and gratitude and overcame anxiety in the midst of suffering. And I could show you all that research. Maybe I will sometime. But I didn't think that's where we need to go today. Today, I want to leave you with something different. I want to leave you with a sense of what Christians are going through all around the world today, a sense of that persecution. And I could think of no one better than my friend Nadine. Nadine Mayenza is a friend of mine, has been attending New Story for a number of years now. And she is also one of the world's leading voices on international religious liberty. She served under the president and was a commissioner on the International Religious Freedom for America, serving around the globe. So she's working with, so one time I wanted to meet with her and she's like, yeah, I'm meeting with the president of Egypt today. And I was like, oh shoot, I was going to meet with him today. Okay, you go first. All that to say, she is one of the leading voices and experts just championing freedom, religious freedom around the globe. And she knows more about this than anyone I know. So I wanted to invite her just to speak to this today.
Thank you. I want to say what a privilege it is to be a part of this fellowship for me and my family. So I'm going to start with a group particularly close to my heart. And I heard this story. I've heard it, known it for years, but heard it firsthand from survivors just a few months ago when I was in Syria. It just shows the story of what so many people endure because of their religious identity and their faith. So on February 23rd, 2015, these Syriac Assyrians that live along the Khabar River in northeast Syria, they awoke to the sound of rushing water at like 1 or 2 in the morning. And then right after this river that had been dry for 20 years, because Turkey had dammed it and kept the water, frankly, away from the Christians. And then ISIS came down from the mountain range and blocked the Christians on the southern side of the river. And were able to, they killed 10, they captured 250 between the ages of 8 months and 90 years old. And so they took them back up to the mountain initially and spent the first couple of days having different militants try to convince them to convert to Islam, and not one of them did. And just a few weeks before, in a shocking video released to the world, ISIS had executed 21 Coptic Christians, now called the Coptic Martyrs, on a beach in Libya, wearing orange jumpsuits. And these people expected this to be their fate as well. And yet not one of them converted. But ISIS had other plans for them. Instead, they decided to ransom them back to the church to raise money for their own terrorism. So it's reported that they cost about $50,000 a person, raising about $11 million. We don't really know that for sure. And so they released them in small groups as the funds were released, given to ISIS. And then after 9 months or so, ISIS decided to execute 3 of the men in the same similar way to how the Coptic martyrs were killed, in a way to speed up the funding. And so, of course, the church came through, paid for these captives, and then about a year later, they were all released. Although they fled throughout the world, as did much of the 15,000 Assyrians that live along the river. Only a couple thousand still live there. And some of them are still in third countries without citizenship, still struggling. So this particular group is really special. They're among the oldest Christian community in the world. They're part of the Syrian Church of the East that was founded by Apostle Thomas in 33 AD. And their grandparents had actually fled the Armenian genocide out of the Ottoman Empire, now Turkey, to Iraq, where they were also victims of a genocide called the Samil Massacre in 1933, when the Iraqi government tried to eliminate all the Assyrians there. And so the League of Nations put together a committee in Beirut and resettled them in then French Mandate Syria along the Khabar River, where they were pretty much isolated from most of the different political problems of Syria throughout the years until ISIS turned up. These particular Christians are often, people in the West don't really consider them Christian enough. They don't worship like we do. They still speak in Aramaic, a language very close to what Jesus spoke. And they even do these liturgies over 1,000 years old, which are quite beautiful. Yet how many in the West would be able to stand the way they did when they were challenged to deny Christ and they refused? You know, our goal is always to help Christians stay, and we're actually trying to help the ones left to be able to afford to stay and farm and as that's because they've chosen to do that. But sometimes there are instances where if they don't leave, they'll be killed. And so we have been able to help quite a few Christians who have been fleeing in the last couple of months. I just want to share you some of the more recent stories. First of all, in Afghanistan, we've done quite a bit of resettlement of Christian converts, and it's been some of the most difficult work I've ever done. But to explain to you kind of some of the things they're facing, this one Christian family who left to go to Pakistan right after the government fell, told me how the Taliban came for their daughters. Imagine. And so they left all their land, all their possessions. They went to Pakistan with literally nothing to save their daughters. And fortunately, we were able to connect with them, and the Lord opened doors for them to resettle to a third country. And the Taliban also found, when he took over the computer system, found about 150 Christians who had changed their IDs from Islam to Christian. And this was after all the planes had left, because they had all chosen to stay and then targeted them. And so, unfortunately, even a few of them were found even in safe houses by the Taliban and killed, but a lot of them have been able to be resettled. In Sudan, recently a couple who converted to Christianity had their own families petition the court to annul their marriage. So then this regional government in Sudan arrested them for adultery, tried them, convicted them, giving them a sentence of 100 lashings or floggings, which they would not have survived. And the wife was pregnant. So we were able to get them to another country. It was a very complicated extraction, and now that they're safe, but obviously there are plenty others that are still in danger in that country. In another African country, a young woman who converted to Christianity was reported by Islamists by her own family, and this major terrorist group came after her and her Bible study leaders. There were two men that led a Bible study she attended of Christian converts. They actually caught one, and they executed him in a video they uploaded to social media, and then went after her and the other leader, even tweeting against them in English. And it was really, which picture is really shocking, and found them in a border country in a church and surrounded the church. And we were able to get the woman resettled, and she's safer. The man is still in a third country, and a lot of them have trauma that makes it hard to flee, because it's hard to make decisions. I mean, there's just so much that they carry, suffering, as he talked about, that they carry from the trauma they've experienced. And of course, there's a lot of, we try not to sensationalize the sexual violence against girls and women, but you can assume that's a part of all of these attacks. But I want to make it clear, it's not just Islamists that are attacking Christians and other religious minorities, and that's just the recent ones we've been working with. But in India, we see Hindu nationalists partnering with the government, going after Christians and other religious minorities with horrible violence. In Burma, it's Buddhist nationalists that have partnered with the government, going after Muslims, Christians, and others. In fact, just the last couple of weeks, we've seen entire villages of Christians in the Karen area massacred, women, children, and men. And in Pakistan, as you heard about earlier, there's horrible violence against Christians and other religious minorities with discriminatory laws they use as an excuse for this violence, including lynchings, forced conversion, sexual violence on girls and women, desecration of houses of worship. In Nigeria, we're seeing mass violence right now. And a lot of the government, towards Christians, a lot of the governments are saying, oh, it has nothing to do with Christianity, but of course it does. And in China, it's never been harder to be a Christian. Even Christians now that attend these churches that were once safe, the official churches with edited Bibles and those kind of things, now they're being targeted and put into concentration camps or worse, along with the Uyghur Muslims that China has been targeting. And of course, there's so many Christians in countries that just disappear because they're not allowed to even exist in places like North Korea, Saudi Arabia. So just a couple of weeks ago, I was really honored to join Secretary Anthony Blinken as he rolled out the International Religious Freedom Report for the United States, documenting conditions in every country in the world. And even he announced it's worse than it's ever been for religious communities. So it's a scary time, and they definitely need our prayers and support.
So to quote the Apostle Paul, if Jesus isn't raised from the dead, these Christians that we're talking about are to be most pitied. They're fools. They're insane. But then Paul declares, but Christ is risen. And every Christian across time and around the world echoes, he is risen indeed. And so we are more than overcomers. So I want you to stand, and I'm going to leave you with the most uncomfortable blessing you've ever been left with. I'm going to plague you with a blessing. Are you ready? May this message unsettle you. May these words make you uncomfortable with your comfort. May you leave here with a peace that passes understanding, or troubled by your own lack of peace. May you leave here with a burden to pray for those who are persecuted and the boldness to stand if persecution should ever come for you. Go with God. Go in the name of Jesus. Amen.